everyone, and welcome back to Purple Row Radio. My name is Greg Stanwood. I'm a staff writer at PurpleRow.com, and I'm here along with the managing editor of Purple Row, Andrew Martin. Andrew, how are you?
I'm all right. It's been a rainy weekend, and as much as it inhibits good baseball enjoyment, I never get so little rain, and I do enjoy the sunlight, but I must go back to when my first job was lifeguarding, surprisingly enough, rainy, cloudy days meant that, you know, stupid suburbanites weren't going to come and make my life living at the pool, and I still got paid for being there. I mean, granted, we had to, like, do more side work and clean the this and scrub the that and whatever, but it was just a nice change of pace, and I don't know, I kind of like the way the weather gets a little more humid, like Denver humid, not real humid.
Right.
Know? And
fake humid.
Exactly, and it's I sleep better because it's cool and humid outside. Oh, it's nice. I love rainy weather once in a while. I love the change that rainy weather is. I couldn't live in Seattle. I'd need to... I enjoy the sun we get here. I really do. I like the break, the change of pace that Denver gets for having all kinds of weird weather in the spring.
Well, I've already got the reputation amongst most of the listeners who are also read me in Purple Row, who know that I am in love with the rain, and I would be completely fine and content in Seattle or in that one Hawaiian island where it rains constantly. I can't remember what it's called. But I would love to live in a place with that kind of weather, to be honest. It just doesn't – people always tell me, you know, you'd get tired of it. Well, I get tired of the sun when it's there for more than 2 or 3 days. I think I would be comfortable with the clouds.
So I wonder if it's just more the change in weather that I enjoy or if it's actually the – you know, actually the rain I like, or actually the sun I like, or if I just need things to keep changing, or else I get bored.
Right.
I wouldn't doubt that that's the case, but like I said, it does make for a rough baseball. And I'm honestly, every time the Rockies seem to go on a road trip, we get like this beautiful stretch of weather here in Denver where it's like, I mean, so far this spring, this is the way it's been in 2011. Every time the Rockies go on a road trip, we get like, you know, mid 80s, maybe hitting 90s, walking around in shorts and sandals, cool stuff like that. And the minute they get back into town, I'm wearing a hoodie and long pants and a beanie of some sort to keep myself warm because I'm like, yeah, it's freaking cold out here. We don't get the nice, fun, warm rains like you do in the South.
Right. Well, it's certainly, I mean, the Rockies have a somewhat of a reputation for having trouble playing in this kind of weather, and it's not as if we didn't have enough problems to begin with going into the week, but it's been one of those weeks where you know, I don't know how much the weather actually contributed, but I think there were probably a lot of miserable fans in the stands for multiple reasons.
Oh yeah, no, I was there for Saturday's game, and we were lucky enough to be sitting under an overhang, so you know, very thankful for that. But you know, the rain was just constant, and the Rockies still managed to put up 7 runs on Saturday. I mean, they lost, but hey,
at least it's runs. Right? Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, lately, man, I don't know what gives. Honestly, up for the last couple weeks there, it's been everybody's flailing at the plate simultaneously, and we figure, oh, coming home against the Mets will definitely cure our offensive woes. No, just kidding. We beat them 2-1 one game and then lose the next two. Oh, well, the Padres. And then we just, you know, crush them in that first game, sort of. I mean, we won 12-7, which is definitely a crushing. It's beyond a save situation. I guess that's close enough to crushing. But the fact that we let them get back into that game at all was disheartening. And then Saturday, same thing, up 7-1, and then they just came back and took it all away from us. Like, it's one of those things where if we've been winning, you know, maybe even playing 500 ball, or slightly better than 500 ball, everyone goes, oh, it's just one of those series, the bullpen and the pitching has been so solid, you know, we can forgive them these games. But, I mean, they've been the only thing keeping the team afloat the last few weeks, and then finally the bats start hitting, you're like, yes, oh, no, the pitching's going now, oh, no.
Sigh.
I mean, this happens every season, everyone knows it. I mean, not necessarily in this order, but the bats will go cold for a while, and the pitching will keep them afloat, and the pitching goes cold for a while, but the bats are scoring 6-7 runs a game, and that's how every team works. Problem is that these, they seem to be falling in just in the wrong order. The bats are going hot, like, are going so cold that, you know, any slip up from the bullpen is costing the game. And, from, you know, the same way, other way around, when the bats finally get hot, the bullpen does nothing but slip up, and the game's suddenly gone. You're like, what happened to that bases loaded situation in the first inning? Well, we got 7 runs over the game. That should be enough for most major league pitching staffs to win the game.
Mm-hmm. You'd think so, but.
You'd think so. I mean, just, and the thing is, too, it's, for the most part, I mean, yeah, I mean, bottom line is they lost the game. And a lot of, there's a lot of people who are very bottom line about things, say, well, whatever it is, we didn't win. And yeah, that's true, but I mean, if you watched a lot of these games, yes, there's no excuse for how many batters the Rockies have been walking. They lead the National League, if not the majors, in walks. That they were announcing that during Sunday's game, and it's disheartening. I mean, we expected Chacin to get a little, well, now he was a little wilder than we expected last season. Ubaldo is never supposed to be this wild, but Ubaldo is supposed to be a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that De La Rosa was going to be somewhat wild, but just the last few, again, the last few starts, everyone's getting wild at once. If the rest of the staff was doing what they normally do and De La Rosa gets a bit wild for a couple starts, whatever, he'll get through it. And he's going to get through it. It's no, I still have no doubt in that, but it's De La Rosa gets wild and Chacin gets wild and Hamill's even getting, Hamill's not a wild pitcher. He's, under 3 walks per 9, you know, for the last several years here, and he's been the kind of pitcher you don't expect to walk a lot of guys. I mean, the problem with Hamill tends to be, you know, that one nasty error, and then all of a sudden everything becomes a bloop single. And then, honestly, a lot of that's been the problem, too. It just, the walks are inexcusable, there's no question, and I'm not excusing the pitching here, but I mean, a lot of it, like the Padres game on Sunday, we're just watching the pitches, and Polino and Morales both gave a bunch of runs. Morales' pitch was, you know, up in the zone and probably should have been hit, but if you watch the pitches Polino was throwing low in the zone, hitting the corners and stuff like that, and the Padres were still hitting them, and they're doing that whole, you know, level swing, just get the ball in play, get the ball to the outfield somewhere, and instead, the Rockies aren't countering it properly. We need to see the same kind of hitting for the Rockies. Not necessarily small ball and just dinking things everywhere, but honest to God, don't swing for the fences every at bat. And that's, I mean, as much as I love to see Tulowitzki hitting home runs, it's becoming, you know, increasingly apparent that that's all he's trying to do is hit home runs. Like today, he popped one up so badly, it went back to the backstop, and the catcher was able to catch it, and that's the end of Tulowitzki for that at bat. And I don't know, I mean, I feel like a few of the guys on the team were just, they had hit a couple home runs, and now they got that flavor in their mouth, and that's all they want. The only guy I'm excusing from that is Helton. And I don't think the power is gonna, the power resurgence he's having. I mean, he could be hitting 15-20 this year the way he's going, provided his back holds up and all those other good contingencies. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he's the only player on the team that I'm like, whatever, hit your home runs, cause I know that you're next at bat, you're gonna try to send one opposite field and it's not a big deal. But with everyone else in the lineup, it seems, you hit the home run and your next swing is gonna be straight from your heels and you're gonna be, you know, spinning yourself into ground as the ball floats over the infield, and it's been a criticism all season of the team, and for the last year and a half of the team, and it's funny because everyone says, well, the Rockies need to keep swinging, quit swinging for the fences, how can the hitting coach allow this? Well, he's not preaching that. I mean, Lansford's been saying, hey, I've been telling them all season, you know, adjust your stance, hit the ball where it is, send it to the opposite field, use the entire field, hit the gaps, don't go for the, you know, the 5-run home run every time up because you're not going to hit it. And, you know, people are saying, well, that he's obviously not reaching them. Well, you know, there's only so much any coach can do. Is there some magical coach out there that's going to suddenly say, listen, and just drill it into their heads and they're going to be undeniably educated? Or is it just an issue of things take time to adjust? I mean, if everybody's been screwed up over the last, like, season, and I mean, assuming Don Baylor really had the impact that a lot of people claim he has, if you are really swinging for the fences for 2 straight years and you're just not doing things right, or however we want to put it, a hitting coach coming in isn't going to magically turn all that around, especially with a youngish team, in, you know, 3 months. It's just not going to happen. Even if, say, all we did off-season work with such and such and such, why aren't they fixed? Well, that's just it. It's work. There's not a switch on baseball players to make them go from not swinging for the fences and swinging for opposite field. It's just not that simple.
We've had this discussion a lot, over and over and over again about the impact that, the coaches can have and, you know, why certain people feel inclined to point immediately to the hitting coach or the pitching coach or whomever to assign blame there. I definitely would want to get into, talking about that at some point later on. But, you know, right now let's flip over to this other topic that we wanted to get to about, the sort of the baseball Twitterverse And we were talking about this before we started recording, and thought it might make an interesting topic to get started on here. And I had basically mentioned that I include a lot of various players, not only from within our organization but from across baseball, on my Twitter list to follow. And the thing about Twitter, and I don't want to get into too much of a crazy discussion on social media in general, but I don't use it for really anything other than keeping tabs on the sort of live operations of any certain community. So when I add somebody to my baseball list, whether it be a reporter or a pundit or a player or a manager or so forth, it's really just to give myself sort of a picture of the community as it is at any given point. I'm not following certain people because I want to read everything they have to say, or really even anything they have to say. I kind of skim for bits of information that may interest me or may be relevant to me, but 95% of it, is not something that I pay any serious attention to. And I get the impression that you sort of use that sort of access differently.
With my Twitter feed personally, it's I just use it as kind of like a reduced RSS feed and source for quick jokes. Like, for the most part, I don't follow baseball players on Twitter. I follow Dexter Fowler for some reason, and I guess I just don't have the heart to take it off the list. Because it's kind of weird, because I never followed Ian Stewart that much during the all the Ian Stewart Twittergate scandals and stuff like that. After a while, I'm just like, it kind of refreshes in my mind that baseball players are just people. I follow very few just people on Twitter, and it sounds a bit heartless about this, but I don't care where you went for breakfast. I don't care who your girlfriend is, stuff like that. It's very selfish in a sense. It's refreshing to know that players are out there just tweeting whatever they feel like, because they, within reason, obviously, because it shows that they have lives outside of baseball. But once I've reestablished, these guys are just people, I'm like, I don't care what you have to say anymore.
Well, see, I don't really care either, but I guess the point is, for me, I don't use it to build a list or attempt to build a list of information, all of which will be relevant to me, because I don't care if my feed is flooded with junk that I don't care about, because I almost inherently don't care about any of it to begin with. Again, it's sort of a compass to point me to help me recognize whenever something of relevance that I should be aware of is going on, because you'll see these surges and so forth of people talking about one thing in particular. So I kind of just toss anybody who may be relevant to that community onto the list and just skim over whatever I don't care about, basically.
Well, that's what's interesting about following some of the people that I follow, because I follow a lot of the big names like Keith Law from ESPN and Craig Calcaterra for NBC and stuff, because for one, Keith Law and his snark are really interesting to follow when some big controversy hits, just because of the wars they get in over Twitter. And he responds pretty, he responds pretty well to tweets as well. He's responded to a couple of mine, a couple of Andrew Fisher's. Not necessarily that it's like, oh my God, Keith Law's talking to me, but the fact that he's receptive to his online, audience is, it makes it easier to follow someone. But I follow a handful of beat writers. I know I follow, like Joel Sherman for the Yankees. I follow Evan Grant for the Rangers. I believe it's Dean something or other. I can't pronounce his last name. For the Pirates, obviously Rank, Jim Armstrong, Thomas Harding for the Rockies. But when I follow the guy that the beat staffs, and I'm trying to add more and more beat writers because they tend to tweet a little bit less news headline-y stuff. Like I follow John Heyman from Sports Illustrated as well, and mostly it's as kind of a news source thing, and I tend to disagree with Heyman, and he's actually replied to me a little bit too, because with a lot of the writers who don't follow news stats and stuff, they tend to make those throwaway comments in their articles about how, it doesn't matter how many numbers you crunch or what archaic wizardry you bring into baseball. The fact is that the team just isn't hitting right now, or they just aren't pitching well right now. And I kind of roll my eyes and say, yeah, okay, go ahead and issue an entire branch of baseball analysis by calling it wizardry. That's real clever. But, you know, it's still, I guess I just like watching the car wrecks that happen when, you know, they say something like that. And it's kind of the opposite of things with Keith Law. He'll say something like, you know, RBIs are stupid or whatever, and he'll have a zillion tweets at him. You're stupid. You don't understand how baseball works and things like that. Anyways, so if Twitter's not immediate entertainment for me in the forms of, like, Keith Law or internet slap fights, I'm just like, hey, the Pirates have Ryan Dalmont doing a thing, or he wants to talk, or, you know, Ethan Grant wants to talk, or Evan Grant wants to talk about Neftali Feliz is using the bullpen, things like that. It's good insider info that isn't blatant, you know, news headline information. Beat writers will tweet a lot of stuff that they don't put into their articles just because it's kind of stuff they would put in their articles, but after a while, trivia gets a bit heavy into a, you know, into a column, and they just figure Twitter's a better outlet for it.
Yeah, and again, with those entertaining fights that you bring up, those are parts of what I really don't pay attention to. It's one of those things where I have the window up on my browser tab along with like 40 others that I have open all the time. And, you know, I can't even really specify what I'm reading at any given point or what I read earlier in the day. I kind of look over it and then a few things hit me, and I add it to the library of stuff that I need to understand for the day and move on. You know, it's really not a source of entertainment for me either. It's just very much a way to quickly produce information.
Well, that's true. I mean, I'll have it at work where, I mean, a lot of people might, on the website might notice that I'm not around, haven't been around quite as much during the rock piles and stuff. I'm keeping an eye on things, but, you know, busy season of work and all that, but I'll take a step outside the door to be like, what's, you know, taking a 5-minute break from work or 10 minutes or, you know, whatever, lunchtime, and I'll check my Twitter feed and go, oh, crap, Ian Stewart was demoted. Quickly run to the website and say, please tell me someone wrote something. All right, I can use the rest of my break to write something really fast about Ian Stewart getting demoted. It's a great way to get that up to the moment information before we even know. And we actually, that gets us in trouble too, because during the off season when everybody's just tweeting everything they hear, it tends to lead to overreaction and, you know, oh my gosh, my news source just said that the Rockies might be interested in Guy Geyerson from the fighting team, and oh my gosh, but it turns out there's absolutely nothing to it, but they overheard someone saying a thing about a thing. And I don't know, I find the advent of Twitter into the modern media absolutely fascinating, because it's kind of a, and for any beat writers listening to this show, this isn't meant as a personal strike, but it's kind of shows a little bit the fallibility of even of everybody in the sports media with the advent of Twitter, because you're eager to get the news out and eager to get out what you've heard, but you know, the kind of stuff that you put on Twitter isn't necessarily stuff you'd put into an article, because
yes,
it may not be as well researched. It may not be. Well,
I have a funny story about that, actually.
Please, go ahead.
I accidentally caused a little bit of a problem like that earlier. You see, I don't tweet very often as myself. I only do that when I am, you know, have the window open, happen to have an observation, or maybe I read something that one of the other writers on the blog said and I want to weigh in or something like that. It's really pretty minimal. But what happened was, I also run the Twitter account for RockiesRoster.com, and those tweets are mostly automatically generated and sent out automatically. So I had noticed, as you may or may not recall, Eric Young Jr. went on the temporarily inactive list a few weeks ago. Now, the reason that he was placed on the inactive list was because he had gotten injured on a play the previous day, and they didn't want to commit to putting him on the disabled list for a whole week. Now, I had observed that Eric Young had been pulled from the game that previous day. I had no idea why, but basically, I had Andrew Fisher note that Eric Young had been, my Rockies roster tweet, that he had been pulled off, and he wanted to know why. I tweeted from my own account, just casually, that he had been pulled from the previous game, but, you know, I had just assumed that I was being clear that I didn't know why he had been pulled. And, you know, that, I had no idea he'd gotten hurt on the play. And so that chain there kind of got out, and a bunch of people were tweeting him angrily saying, oh yeah, you know, he was pulled because he was hurt, and he's still with the team. There's no permanent stuff going on. They didn't reassign him, which is kind of common when someone's put on the inactive list. If it's going to be for a long time, they're going to send him to extended spring training. So we didn't know what was going on, but you know, it's just one of those things where people got confused and we had to kind of clear up what we meant. But yeah, it's just funny how all that goes on. But anyway,
lesson to be learned for everyone. Make sure if you don't know what's going on, say, I don't know what's going on.
Right. You have to devote some of your characters to that. But again, my understanding was, you know, when I tweet something under the Rockies roster account, I already know for sure that that's what it is. You know, that's what I use that Twitter for. When I reply with my own personal account, you know, I'm speaking as a completely subjective interpretation that's not necessarily had any research done into it. So
I see. So the bottom line is, don't trust Greg. All right. I see what's going on.
I only have 38 followers. I would have a lot more, but I'm one of those that protects my account. You know, I don't want 500 followers. And I mean, you know, when I get these people who request to follow me, I have no idea who any of these people are. There's random accounts from, you know, all over the place. Some of them are advertisements for like local Denver bars and stuff like that. I'm like, I don't want to clutter up some account with all this junk. You know?
No, I decline those too. If it's just like, you know, Rockies fan 743, hey, congratulations. I hope you enjoy all my retweets of funny things that I see and stuff that Andrew Fisher already tweeted. You know, welcome, but I feel like half my Twitter list is the various offshoots of the Denver Post.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, that was a long discussion on Twitter, but we do have a reason for why that ended up being brought up. We were talking about some of the minor league stuff that's going to be going on, and as we know, we have the draft coming up in just under a month now. And, you know, the organization will change significantly when that happens. We're going to launch, of course, the two short season teams, begin their play, and we were a little uncertain about exactly the procedure of how that would go down, you know, when extended spring training actually ends. And my understanding is that it ends a little bit before the draft does. It's still going on right now as far as I understand it, because there's plenty of players who are not with a team right now in the organization, and you know, they need to be playing somewhere. And so I think that it's going on for a few more weeks, and then cuts out for, you know, at least a brief period of time while the draft goes on, and then the team takes all the people who sign right away, and then it will issue assignments to all the remaining players as to where they're going to wind up. And you know, one of the advantages to following players in the organization on Twitter is you get information about, you know, even if you don't care where they went for breakfast, you know when they're, you know, home or
going on to see mom and pops, you know, things like that, taking a quick vacation to Cali while waiting for the season to start, things like that.
Right. So, you know, if we have 4 or 5 players who aren't currently assigned to a team yet headed over to, you know, in various corners of the country for no reason suddenly, we can guess that extended spring training is probably over. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Ian Stewart, who was demoted for the second time this season when Ty Wigginton was activated from the disabled list. You know, a lot of people are I should say, first of all, I thought this was a pretty much a no-brainer move. I didn't expect anything else. But apparently it caught a lot of people by surprise. I don't really understand. I mean, we knew that they hadn't planned to recall him anyway, and it was just Wigginton going on the disabled list that kind of forced the move to begin with. I think they would have left him down there. But, yeah, so he's back down there, and, you know, people are saying, should we let him rebuild himself down there? Should we consider a trade? And, you know, I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, it's funny. I remember a few years ago when when Jeff Francoeur was still with the Braves, and he was having just the first of his miserable seasons, and the Braves said, look, we don't know what's wrong with your swing, but we want to kind of get you out of the limelight a little bit. We're going to send you down to double-A ball. Just because we have a hole down there and we just want you to get at bats where you don't care about the results, you're just worrying about swinging properly and blah, blah, blah. Well, he got sent, it's this big hoopla because, you know, you don't send a major leaguer like Jeff Francoeur down to the minors after having so many successful seasons. What are you doing? Especially double A. And the worst part was like 2 days later, maybe, you know, less than a week later, someone gets hurt and he has to be recalled to the majors. Like, so it was this big hoopla and embarrassment and egg on everyone's face. And then all of a sudden they're calling him right back up. It seemed to be the kind of the same thing with Stewart. He was, having all these problems. I guess the difference is that Stewart never had any of the success that Francoeur had with the Braves before, getting demoted. I mean, I guess he kind of did. I mean, he had a 23 home run season and stuff like that, but, you know, no one ever hailed him as being the, you know, a big awesome player because he just never seemed to put the entire thing together in a fashion that everybody liked. And so, getting demoted wasn't a surprise at all. And I understand why they called him back up, but did the team really think that 11 days in the minors was going to do that much good for Ian Stewart? I mean, the guy missed a couple weeks of spring training, which has been seemingly the internal excuse of myself and every other person trying to defend Ian Stewart. But, I mean, the amount of catch-up the guy has had to play, he's just clearly not in a major league state of batting. And when they sent him down the first time, yeah, I mean, he crushed the minors. But I always see it when you have a major leaguer and you send him down to the minors, it's to fix one or two specific problems, not to just say – or, I mean, almost like an Ioannidis case in 2010, he got sent down because, yeah, he started off the season abysmally. I mean, a lot of the indicators were there that he was doing a lot of things well. Like when he hit the ball, it was for power, and he was still walking at a good rate and stuff. It just looked like he wasn't getting into the swing of things as far as getting decent contact on the ball. And he gets sent down to the minors because Miguel Olivo was just on a ridiculous tear, and they figured they'd call it Paul Phillips because, I mean, no offense to Paul Phillips, but he wasn't going to factor into the Rockies' long-term catching plan, so... You know, they figure, what the crap, we don't care if this guy plays once a week and, you know, never gets into the swing of things. We just want him to be able to receive the ball well, but we have higher hopes for Ioannidis, so we want to keep him down there longer. So in Ioannidis' case, for the most part, was get into a steady swing of at-bats and start squaring at the ball a bit, and let's see what you can do when you come back up. And, you know, for the record, at the point he got called back up, if you look at his numbers from that part of the season to the end of the season and stack him against Miguel Olivo's, Ioannidis was the better batter at the time. But with Stewart, the problem obviously was it was a combination of not squaring out the ball, taking too many giant swings, striking out just way too much. As it stands, Stewart strikes out too much, and everyone knows it, and everyone harps on it. But this is just, you know, otherworldly bad. This is something is wrong. Let's get you to a less competitive environment. Well, not less competitive, but, you know, let's get you down to AAA and just try to iron this out. And so he goes down to AAA, and, you know, everyone goes, oh, he's mashing the ball. He's hitting the crap out of the ball. And he was. He was high batting average, lots of homers, stuff like that, but the problem still remained that he was striking out way too much, and it's like they never really got around to addressing that because of the urgency of the call-up when Wigginton went on the DL. It was, you know, we know you still have the existing problems, Stu, but we gotta, you know, we need someone in there to be our third base starter, and he came up and just looked just as bad as before he got called down. I mean, maybe slightly better. Some bigger hits to the outfield. Everything wasn't just a dribbler to the infield, but at the same time, when I say bigger hits, I mean bigger flyouts because he wasn't getting hits. But the problem still remained that he was still looked lost on the inside strike, and he wasn't getting around on the baseball still. So, you know, Wigginton's back, Stewart's down again, and honestly, assuming nothing bigger goes down, like a trade of Ian Stewart or whatever, we'll see in July, maybe. We'll see how things are going down in the minors because you've got a lot of work to do. A lot of work to do.
Now, you mentioned the possibility of a trade. I know a lot of people are, harping on the wagon that maybe we should look into exploring a trade for Ian Stewart. Now, I have two problems with this to begin with. For one thing, we'd be selling pretty low.
That's the biggest one there. I mean, any GM knows that when they send down their youngish, prospect-ish type player who's struggling huge, that they're at a relatively low value. When it's someone like Gordon Beckham or Jordan Schaefer for the Braves or someone like that, there's a lot of upside still that the team sees, and they're still kind of in that prospecty status where it's like, we're not losing this guy right now. He's just not ready yet. Or Travis Snyder for the Jays would be another example. But like last year, again, I keep bringing up Iannetta because there's a kind of a little bit of similarity there. When Iannetta got sent down, MLB trade rumor says Iannetta sent down, possible trade candidate. And of course, all the teams that were missing a catcher were like, oh, trade us Iannetta. We'll trade you, you know, crappy double A starter or whatever for Iannetta. That's a fair trade. He looks like crap. Well, no, because they're still stocking Iannetta. They're still stocking Ian Stewart.
Can I interrupt you real quick?
Please.
Because I have a comment about that. One of the things that most amuses me about Rockies trade rumors from a non-Rockies fan perspective is how everybody always assumes that what the Rockies really need is more good pitching. Because the Rockies, you play in a park where they can never have good pitching, so they need all the pitching they can get, right? So if we trade you a C-plus pitching prospect for your most recent offensive,
challenge.
That should be an obvious done deal. It's just so funny to me how you read the comment threads of these things and they're like, hey, the Rockies don't need any offense, so, you know, they should be just perfectly content with whatever pitching that we happen to throw in there. So it's just one of those observations where we still have that reputation of being an offensive-minded baseball team with no pitching. And in fact, this season, it's been pretty much exactly the opposite.
Well, yeah, I mean, but especially with Ubaldo struggling so much this season, everyone assumes, well, the Rockies have no ace, and there's nobody after Ubaldo Jimenez, nobody at all. I mean, here this Aaron Cook guy's okay, but he's hurt, so they're obviously tossing out a bunch of quadruple-A pitchers. Yeah, no, that's not the case. do a little bit of homework, please, commenters.
Mm-hmm. Well, back to what you were saying about trades. In addition to it being selling low, the reason players have option years like this is precisely for accounting for things like this happening. You know, it's not just for holding somebody on the roster for as long as you can, right? Someone like Ian Stewart can benefit from something like this, and it may be frustrating to see a player having to be paid, you know, 2 point whatever complicated number Ian Stewart has being paid to him this year, million, to sit down there. But it's funny how people get so conservative about the budget when we're paying somebody to play in the minors, but they're the complete opposite when they're mad at a player and they just want him released. Like, you know, it sucks to pay Stewart $2.75 million in the minors, but oh yeah, releasing the 3.6 of Jose Lopez outright, no problem.
Yeah, it's a bit of a double standard.
Certainly.
I guess the thought is that they see more out of Ian Stewart than they do Jose Lopez,
So
they're saying, you know, we'll just, you know, bite the bullet on someone who clearly sucks like Jose Lopez, and a lot of people even say that about Stewart. He clearly sucks, bite the bullet. But they know that they clearly know that there's still value there from Stewart, or else they wouldn't even be complaining about the minors. They wouldn't even be thinking about trade.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this point, from my perspective, it's not the time to trade him. Keep him down there. And
it's not going to hurt the team to keep. I mean, it sucks to have to pay him money to be in the minors, but I mean, you know, real money, like major league money. But at the same time, I mean, would you rather pay him to play the minors right now and hopefully fix him, or bite the bullet, eat $2 million, and then watch him blossom in, you know, Toronto or whatever?
Well, the other way to look at it is, we're going to be paying him that money anyway, and even though it's annoying to have to pay him basically to not play for the team right now. The question is, would you rather be paying him that money to not be causing problems for the team offensively, or would you rather be paying him money sitting there and not really accomplishing anything at the major league level, which was where he was at that point? So, yeah, I would go with option A in that case.
I mean, Wigginton's obviously a serviceable stand-in. I mean, he's going to pretty much be a full-time player from here on out until Stewart somehow magically shows that he's a major league starter again. You know, Wigginton's going to play full-time third base, and when Talton needs to rest, Wigginton's going to play first base, and they'll give Jose Lopez another shot at third base, because, well, that's the only, you know, really logical option. Mm-hmm. If you want to if you want to try to feign some sort of production out of the third base position.
Now, I obviously already have an opinion on this, but I just want to ask you, because a lot of people have been taking note of Josh Fields at Colorado Springs. Now, for those who don't follow the minors, we acquired Fields at the beginning of the season after spring training. He'd signed a minor league deal with the Pirates, and this is a guy who was once a huge third base prospect for the White Sox, right? They think so?
I believe so.
He played a couple of years there. He might have had one good year, but eventually became somewhat of a disappointment for them. They flipped him over to Kansas City, where he tried to catch on last year, and then they non-tendered him at the end of the season. Now, the obvious precursor to bringing up any good performance for the Colorado Springs Sky Sox is everybody can perform well with the Colorado Springs Sky Sox. People love to say everybody hits well with them. Well, that's not necessarily true. You still have to take some stock into the offensive performance. And I mean, it's not like they play every game there either. But at the same time, I feel like just about anybody can put up some lopsided offensive numbers down there should the cards fall in their way. But with Fields, to the credit of people who are considering him as a viable replacement, he's not just putting up exaggerated numbers down there right now. He's having a good year.
He's crushing it down in AAA. There's no question about it. I mean,
he is an OPS leader in the organization for sure. I don't know how he ranks there right now, but definitely somebody to keep an eye on, I would say. I will get more in-depth into it as to why I don't necessarily think that people should be jumped to that conclusion, but you were about to say something. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that he's in 29 games down in AAA Colorado Springs. Fields is batting .371 right now. 7 home runs and 1,159 OPS. That's those are phenomenal numbers. I mean, this isn't just, you know, Colorado Springs makes it easier to do things.
Right. Not everybody hits .371 down there.
It's a big difference. Big difference. I mean, there's people who, you know, like Vinny Castilla, for example, who wasn't that great of a third base, or not third baseman, but just a batter in general before he came to Colorado, and all of a sudden he's a 40 home run guy, which obviously speaks to the nature of a pre-humidor Coors Field, but there were still guys who sucked in Coors Field. And just that just kind of says they're not that good of a batter. If you suck in AAA Colorado Springs, you're probably just not that good, or injured, or whatever other contingency, but you probably shouldn't be. I mean, unless you have a specific minor league rehab role like we mentioned earlier, and that's not – I mean, if that's the only reason you're down, then yeah, sure, whatever. But if you're just like, all right, go to AAA, see what you can do, and you bat like, you know, .320 with a .900 OPS, well, it doesn't necessarily mean you're doing that great, especially if it's a slugging heavy, because it's just – it's a real pitcher-friendly environment. But when you talk about like – these are all-star Hall of Fame level numbers in AAA. I mean, there's got to be something to be said for that, because it's not just going to be all home batting. You got to be doing something right to put up that consistent of a stat line.
Right.
Or that strong of a stat line. That's just not necessarily consistent.
So at this point, I would say it's not unreasonable to look at Fields as somebody to consider further on down the line as somebody who could be beneficial. You still have all these traditional problems with that you get with players like him. Okay, he's not on the roster. We would have to make some changes. And, you know, that's not always a huge issue, but sometimes it's still a factor in the decision. And further, as you were kind of hinting at earlier, you can't get too excited about minor league numbers just because they are legitimately crushing the ball. While I think it would be unfair to say that Josh Fields is a product of AAA pitching, or that he is a product of Colorado Springs type offense, at the same time, it's not fair to assume that that's going to translate if you call him up.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely not. Especially if it depends on the kind of production they're putting up. Because if it's, I mean, it's obviously going to be slugging heavy. But if it's like slugging heavy. Then you gotta wonder how much of it's a park of it. There's a lot of nuances to how to interpret an extreme hitter's park stat lines, especially when we're talking between multiple levels of baseball organizations.
And we have to remind people that his major league track record is not all that fantastic, and it's completely viable to assume that such a similar struggle would occur if we gave him a shot. I wouldn't rule it out for that reason. But
well, for what it's worth, of a 13 games last year with Kansas City, Fields batted .306, .320, .490, which is obviously very, very slugging heavy call up there. He hit 3 home runs in those 13 games, good stuff like that. But for the rest of his career, he is he had one good season in 2007 with the White Sox where he batted it was only a 244, 308, 480 batting line. He hit 23 bombs though, and it was almost Jose Lopez-esque as far as his batting line, except with surprisingly a few more walks. So I mean, there's something to be said about Fields. There's something there, but
Going back to Kansas City though, that they must have not liked something because they outright non-tendered him at the end of the season. This wasn't just he left on his own accord. They said, you know, it's not worth keeping you on the roster, man. Go set sail and find somewhere new. So I would say that it's regarding Fields at this point, don't rule him out, but don't get too excited either. I think there's no real reason to not see what Ty Wigginton can do with regular at-bats there at this point.
Yeah, so. I think the negative, the most pessimistic view that we could probably have is, you know, Wigginton kind of craps the bed, Jose Lopez never comes back together, but the problem is we don't really have a third baseman still. It's going to be just kind of a merry-go-round of utility-type players like Alfredo Amezaga and Josh Fields if he comes up, and
Chris Nelson maybe would be in that discussion.
Exactly. Nelson, maybe even, who knows, Eric Young, and then Jose Lopez is obviously going to get his playing time in there as well. You might even see Johnny Herrera shuffled in there, depending on who comes up. Unless Wigginton really grabs this and continues at least being an average producer at third base. Because honestly, at this point in the season, I would turn cartwheels for average performance from the third base position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're certainly not getting in anywhere near. We had that one post I think Andrew Fisher put up that showed just how little production has come out of that spot. And it's not just for me and Stewart. It's from the people who have been in the game because we can't play Ian Stewart either.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, Wigginton had a really rough start, which if you look at the three of them together, Stewart was striking out every other at-bat, if not more often than that. Lopez, well, you could say it's just a lot of ball and play bad luck. A lot of it was really bad swings, really weak grounders in the infield, and so on and so forth. But Wigginton seemed to have all those markers of he's actually looks like he's doing all right. He's walking a fair amount. He's hitting for okay power when he hits it. He's just not finding hits right now. There's a lot of gloves involved right there. But when you look at the 2 weeks before his trip to the DL, he was hitting very well, like a 280 batting average, 900 OPS, something like that. And it's only a 2 week stretch, so you obviously don't put much stock in that. But there were signs that he was, starting to see the other side of that. That ball and play luck thing. And Jose Lopez had a couple hits on Sunday too. So, I mean, I'm not crossing my fingers or holding my breath or putting any money on this, but who knows? Maybe he's starting to, peek his way out of this bad luck spell and getting some better results off of, some of these balls in play.
Yeah. We kind of mentioned last week that, Jose Lopez was having a rough time finding places to land the ball. And, well, you can't attribute his lack of performance to entirely to bad luck, but there were times where he could have had an opportunity to be more productive than he was, where that was sort of taken away. And it's good to see that that's sort of kind of finally starting to even out a little bit. I think, actually, I was driving around on I-70 earlier and listening to the pregame show for today's game, and they mentioned that they had talked to Jose Lopez about that, and they asked him if he was getting frustrated by the fact that he wasn't finding the right spots, and the reply was just kind of what you'd expect. No, not getting frustrated. It's all going to even out, and so forth. So,
well, everything we've read about Jose Lopez so far has been, obviously the numbers have been terrible, and we've seen him play, and it hasn't been great. But he's having a good attitude about it, at least, which is, very, very small consolation. But he's saying, I know that I'm having trouble right now, and in my entire career, I've been used to being the second baseman, especially with some of his success in Seattle, but he says, it's weird not being able to take at-bats, or, get a start, for 4 days at a time, But, I mean, he's being very positive, and he's not throwing fits about things, and he's saying, I'm willing to pinch hit and come into the game whenever I'm needed to, so I'm just going to do my best with what playing time I get. And granted, it's a canned answer, but, I mean, I'd almost rather hear the canned answer than hearing him start to throw a fit about things, which he's not, and there's no sign that he's going to. But, I mean, at least he is not at a point where he feels like he should say something other than the standard issue baseball player line, well, I'm not doing great right now, and I feel bad about that, but I'm willing to help the team however I'm needed, and hopefully I can start getting some hits.
Let's talk about Aaron Cook really quickly. Cook had his first rehab start yesterday, and we have to keep in mind regarding Cook, he has not really pitched in game situations at all. He's going to have a long assignment because he has to go through spring training all over again, basically. Dan O'Dowd said in an interview a couple days ago that he feels that Cook is completely healthy. Both the finger and the shoulder, he had problems with both. As you may remember, he started off the spring training sitting because he was having shoulder issues, and then as he was starting to get healthy, I can't remember if he actually broke his finger, but he slammed it in a door.
It was broken, yeah.
Well, apparently all that's fixed up, and now we have to let Cook get 4 or 5 rehab starts. I think the plan is for 3 at AA and then reevaluating, moving him up, and so on and so forth.
He's definitely on a spring training regime so far. I mean, his first start in Tulsa was only 4 innings long.
Yes.
Threw something like 50 to 70 pitches somewhere in there, but the results weren't great. He walked 2 batters, struck out 1, and hadn't allowed 4 runs to cross on 6 hits. But at the same time, he also had like 7 ground balls to no air outs.
Yep.
Or something like that. And
yep.
Really what they're worried about is what we've been worried about for 2 years now is getting that sinker back to where it was, having him trust his own sinking fastball to be a pitch you can throw for strikes. And we've seen him, you know, the last 2 years just have trouble getting the sinker bite. And then once you lose faith in your own fastball, you start to try to junk around with slurves and stuff like that. And yeah, Cook has good supplementary pitches to go with that sinker, but, he's one of the heavier fastball throwing pitchers in the league as far as pitch selection. It's like sinker, 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 changeup, sinker, 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 slurve, sinker, 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 some sort of other breaking pitch. And if he's not throwing that sinker well in those 80% of the time he throws it or whatever, he's gonna be getting hit all over the park, especially when that sinker straightens out. And I mean, the ground balls are good, but we're obviously seeing with 6 hits and 2 walks over 4 innings that there's still work to be done. And this isn't him crucifying Cook either. Like you said, he's on a spring training schedule right now, and, you know, hopefully he'll be able to pick this back up and, you know, maybe stabilize the pitching a little bit. Cause right now it's a 3.5 man rotation, maybe 4 if we count Clay Mortensen as the other half. Cause Ubaldo's not the pitcher he once was at the moment. Anyway, he's not pitching like it. And we have a rotation of DLR, Chacin, and Hamill, and then question mark at the 5. I mean, it's obviously Mortensen right now, but you see the point.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of people have been really impressed with Mortensen in terms of what he's shown. But, you know, just like any other person who could possibly be occupying that spot, like Greg Reynolds or so forth, you know, it's great that he's been showing success, but I'm not going to give him the spot right now over someone like Aaron Cook. I mean, I know people are down on Cook right now because he did not show his best stuff last season, even though a lot of that was just bad luck. It still wasn't where we needed him to be in order to have that rotation be successful. You see people commenting that, you know, oh, Mortensen's earned that spot. He should not be demoted in favor of Aaron Cook. Well, I'm not sure that's certainly not realistic from the operational standpoint, but I don't think Mortensen's going to be in the rotation very long, to be honest with you, even if he keeps doing well. I mean, it's just he's not enough of a mainstay that unless Cook gets another setback and Esmil Rogers can't be activated for a while, unless he gets, like, you know, 4 to 6 weeks straight of really effective pitching, I don't consider him to be fully planted into that rotation, if that makes sense.
And very few people are fooled by it either. I mean, not that Mortensen's trying to fool us, obviously, but there's a reason. He just kind of is what he is. He's a number 6 starter. He's a swing man. He's the the fill-in when your other pitchers are hurt, and he's doing an admirable job of it right now, keeping the ball low, keeping it on the ground, and that's kind of what we need out of that spot right now, just someone who can go and give us a six-inning start. Because, I mean, the pitching is just... It's so weird to say the pitching is overworked, but I think it's almost more of a mental overworking than it is actual inning loads, because, you know... If the bats were hitting well and the Rockies were still first place in the division and they were, you know, still a solid like 7 games over .500 or whatever, then we'd be saying, oh, well, the pitching's just, we wouldn't think twice about it because the pitching's just doing what we want to see the pitching do, going 6-7 innings a night and, you know, keeping the team in the game. But because of all this, you know, because of the fact that the bats are giving them 2-3 runs a night recently, with the exception of the Padres series, there's no question that the pitching's been mentally taxing, and I've got to keep us in this game or else we're screwed. And I just wonder if that mental taxation is taking its toll already, rather than... not to say the team's not mentally sound. That's kind of... I'm obviously not a team psychologist, and I'm not in their heads or anything like that, but it does lead me to wonder if they are, you know, pitching with a mindset of one slip up and the game is over, and it's causing them to, you know... lose focus after they cruise for 5-6 innings, and then suddenly, you know, like Chacin on Saturday, cruise for 6 innings, and then 7th inning, suddenly he can't get the ball across the plate, everyone's walking, and he leaves them jacked with no outs for Matt Lidstrom.
It's a really interesting way to look at it, because as I run through the people who have pitched in the bullpen, which has been our most consistent area, not only in performance, but in the fact that we've had the same 7 people in there, plus Clayton Mortensen for a little bit as an extra reliever for the whole season. And as I look through them, I kind of realize all of them except maybe Matt Reynolds seem like they've been put in a lot of weird positions in terms of having to come into games where maybe they wouldn't have been expected to pitch, or just like the example you used, you know, oh, we have a starter cruising along, suddenly the entire pace of the game changes, there's a complete paradigm shift, and suddenly all the pressure goes from non-existent to all in the bullpen all at the same time.
Oh, entirely. I mean, when Justine left the game with a 7-1 lead and had the bases jacked, then there was that error happened that scored 2 runs, and then that Lindstrom got the 3 outs there. He didn't do them in that bad of a fashion. If he'd been brought in with a clean inning, no damage. I mean, yeah, a runner would have reached first, but, I mean, you know, flyouts and stuff like that, they're going to hurt with a runner on third, but with a runner on first, I mean, unless it's a ridiculous flyout, you know, one of those to the deepest corner of Coors Field and center field where the runner could tag up from first and go to second, that's, you know, a 4-up, 3-down inning.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know. We're reaching that kind of point where we want to point fingers at the people making the decisions now, where, oh, well, how could Jim Tracy have left Chacin in there for the 7th inning? He clearly didn't have his stuff after 1 batter. And then after 2 batters, well, he clearly doesn't have his stuff. And why did it take him that long to get the bullpen going? And, well, I mean, at some point, there's a line, a fine line for him to walk. And the one of the lines is, you know, I have no faith in my starters and I'm going to yank them the first sign of trouble. And it's the other point of, well, Chacin can't be going in some of these sailing pitches for an entire inning. He's got to work through this and get out of this inning because his pitch count wasn't extraordinary at that point, and he was still looking like, you know, he could get through the 7th inning. And when he hit a snag there, it's like, you got to find a way to get to that snag, man. And I really don't fault Jim Tracy for leaving him in there until it was too late because, I mean, like I said, you got to have faith in your rotation at some point. And we're not talking about putting Chacin in the 9th inning after he's thrown 115 pitches and then he starts to labor. We're talking about, you know, you haven't pitched a, you know, an eyebrow-raising workload. You should be able to get through that 7th inning. And, yeah, we'll give you the yank after the 8th and put in the, you know, whoever. But, you know, you got – I mean, if you're at 80 pitches starting the 7th inning, you've got to get out of that 7th inning in good shape.
Anything else that you want to opine about before we take off here?
Not really. I mean, it kind of is what it is right now. And like I said, if the team had been playing better for the past couple weeks here, these losses would be frustrating. But we'd say, well, the bullpen was bound to have their hiccup eventually here. But, I mean, after the bats all had this, you know, 2-week slump here, it's just poor timing for the bullpen to have their hiccup now. And, I mean, I don't fault them. It was the hiccups happen, but it just – it was like last week when they had those like three walk-offs in a row where it was just, that was Betancourt's night to have a hiccup. That was Street's night to have a hiccup. And it just keeps piling on, and the normally excusable hiccups are suddenly becoming this team just doesn't have it together.
Well, we've got an interesting week coming up. We have three opponents. We have a two-game series coming up now against San Francisco. Then we head all the way out to Philadelphia for Wednesday and Thursday, stop back in Milwaukee for the weekend series, and then after that comes Monday the 23rd. That'll be an off day, and we should be back with you for another edition of the show then. So before
you run off, though, keep your eye on this week here, because we were able to dodge Lincecum and Kane in the last Giants series and yet still lost. Oh, no, we're getting the full brunt of every opponent right now. We're getting Lincecum and Kane in the Giants series.
I thought we were getting Sanchez
We might be getting Sanchez. We are getting tougher pitchers this time from the Giants, although we should have hit the crap out of Ryan Vogel's song, but whatever. That's neither here nor there anymore. But in Philadelphia, we're going to be getting possibly Halliday, Hamels. I don't think we hit Cliff Lee. I think we have Blanton. But we get tough pitchers there. And then in Milwaukee, we got Greinke and Markham if everything stays in order. So,
Okay. Yeah. Lovely. Looking forward to that.
Not what anybody wants to hear when you're about to head off into a road trip, but you know what? I'm just going to cross my fingers.
At the same time, sometimes these are those weird chances where you beat up on, you know, say tomorrow we have a good game against Lincecum, or I guess today, wink, wink, right? Suddenly have this powerful momentum that allows us to touch just about anybody. And as we've commented on the past couple seasons, sometimes it seems like the top of the line pitchers that we face are the ones that get a team going if you manage to strike against them. So
it would be definitely a feather in our caps if we find a way to turn around against a pile of aces.
Well, we can hope that this next week goes well and that maybe everybody will be in a better mood coming up next week. So until then, on behalf of myself and Andrew,